You're at home or on the road with the Weekend Go Show, Monitor 66. This is David Wayne. In 3 minutes, the dramatic story of a battlefield air rescue in Vietnam. Nero's piano and one of the Beatles' songs, Help. Speaking of help, one of the vital combat operations in Vietnam is the responsibility of the various helicopter rescue and recovery squadrons. Their job is not an easy one under ordinary battle conditions, but it's especially difficult in Vietnam since the combat area is usually in the middle of heavy jungle. For a glimpse of the methods used during these missions, listen as helicopter pilot Captain Edwin Henningsen relates a particularly unusual rescue operation as he talks with our reporter, Lieutenant Bill Knowlton.
Captain, for the months that you've been here, no doubt you've been on many rescue missions and missions of mercy in this HH-43F helicopter. I wonder if you could tell us, though, specifically about one of these rescue missions that you've been on.
Well, I can. I have one that sticks in my mind. It's the kind of a mission that I'll perhaps remember for a lifetime. There was a large battle going on up north of Benoit in what is known as D-Zone, infamous D-Zone, I guess you'd say. And the elements of the United States Army were engaged with a very large force of Viet Cong and had suffered some pretty substantial casualties. And a large number of these needed immediate evacuation and surgery, or they would probably not survive the night. The only problem was that the trees in this jungle area reached up 150 to 180 feet in height, and it made it nearly impossible to get any kind of normal aeromedic evac type helicopter in there to haul these wounded people out. On top of that, it was deep in the jungle, and it would have taken hours, if not days, to pack them out on stretchers or trucks. We have this specialized hoist equipment here that has 200-foot hoist cable, and it enables us to reach down in these deep trees to recover these people. So they called us, and we scrambled out to the site. And at the time we arrived, there was a considerable amount of ground fire, and the ground battle was going pretty hot and heavy. In this thick jungle canopy, we couldn't tell exactly where the survivors were, so we called for smoke, and they ignited a smoke grenade to tell us just where we might be able to pick these people up. However, when we called for smoke, we found smoke in three places. So we asked what kind of smoke they were using. They said yellow, and these other two were red, so we knew it was a VC trying to suck us into a trap. So we just disregarded the others and went to the yellow smoke. And then, with the help of the people on the ground, they had a radio frequency that we were able to monitor. They ground vectored us over this area where all the wounded were. There was no hole in the trees, no clearing, and so we merely had to do the best we could to work the Stokes litter, which is a basket-type stretcher that you can strap a wounded person in. And it has an attachment that we can fit onto the hoist, which enables us to run it up and down. All in all, throughout the day, we hoisted 12 people, 12 survivors, up out of the deep hole in the jungle floor below. We found that when the day's work was done, it spanned about 6 hours total. We flew 4.5 or 5 hours and made some 35 sorties in and out of the trees. It was one of those days, as I said, that you'll remember for a lifetime. And, well, the job we have over here, it kind of makes a fellow feel good to know he has a small part in the overall effort over here. But it's really a gratifying experience to know that you've had an opportunity to be instrumental in saving somebody's life.
Captain Edwin A. Henningsen, part pilot, part fireman, part rescuer, and part medic, but all in all, a good Samaritan, as are all the other members of the 38th Aerospace Rescue and Recovery Squadron. This is Bill Knowlton reporting from the flight line at Tan Sanut Air Base, just outside Saigon, Republic of Vietnam, for Monitor.
It takes a story like that by Captain Henningsen to make the war in Vietnam a less remote and more personal involvement. Now, a pretty ballad from Barbra Streisand's latest album. The song is titled Starting Here, Starting Now.
Starting here, starting now. When we walk, we'll walk together. Year by year. Starting here, starting.
sheriff an opinion, well, that man who created Little Abner has plenty of them, and he's willing to share them. We mean Al Capp, of course, and he's just 6 minutes directly ahead on the monitor beacon. What are your plans for September? I realize it's a bit premature to ask that question, but it's brought to mind by Tony Bennett's latest ballad. So think of flaming foliage, back-to-school clothes, and football games as you listen to Tony sing Maybe September.
Maybe September, I'll love again. Maybe a rainbow will catch me then. This little boy lost will find his way once more, just like before, when lips were tender.
How about this? The car with the biggest, most powerful Standard 6 in its class wins in the Mobile Economy Run. Yes, Rambler American, with the same big engine that won in acceleration at Daytona, wins Class A test for compact sixes in the Mobile Economy Run. Averages 23.8 miles per gallon with automatic transmission as certified by the United States Auto Club to beat every car in its class. What's more, Rambler chalked up the best mileage of any car, any class, for the fifth straight year. How's that for an acceleration champ? See Rambler American 440 and Rambler American 220, the lowest list-priced car made in the USA, at your American Motors Rambler dealer, especially now during Big Win Weeks. Prices are low, deals have never been better. Rambler American built with you and your safety in mind. Every minute of every working day, two more families make their choice, a new American Motors car, because quality is built in, not added on. Almost everything these days is a matter of opinion. Just ask Al Capp. He'll be glad to agree or disagree, as the case may be. He's our expert on nothing, with opinions on everything, and right now the subject for comment is fan mail from Lilac Terrace. Here is Al Capp.
Now, say you were a fender repairer. Would you be thrilled to have Hans Foxdahl of Lilac Terrace, Los Angeles, write and tell you that you were one of his very favorite fender repairers and ask you to repair a fender for him for free? Or let's say you're a brain surgeon and Hans Foxdahl wrote to tell you that you were one of his very favorite brain surgeons. Would you drop whatever head you were working on and do a little brain surgery on Hans for free? Or would you say, who in the name of all that makes Tab Hunter divine? Who is Hans Foxdahl? Well, now, that's what I said when I received a letter from Hans Foxdahl of Lilac Terrace, Los Angeles, telling me that I had always been one of his favorite people and that he'd finally decided to include me in his collection of his favorite people, and would I send him my autograph and draw a cartoon for him on a sheet from a loose-leaf notebook he sent me, labeled The Foxdahl Collection, My Favorite People, unquote. Now, I didn't know then, nor do I know now, what Hans Foxdahl's profession is, but even if he were, say, the hairdresser I adored most in all the world, I wouldn't ask him to do my hair for free, and so I simply send him my autograph. It was promptly returned to me. The word favorite above was crossed out. My autograph was obliterated with ferocious scratches in red ink, and underneath, Hans Foxdahl had written, I'm not that hungry. Well, I could see that I disappointed a true friend, so I wrote the following letter of apology. I'll read it to you. Dear Hans Foxdahl, I wrote, generally, when I receive letters from pests I've never met asking me to draw cartoons for their private amusement, I react to say a grocer or a TV repairman would, at a request from a perfect stranger to give him some vegetables or fix his TV set for free, I throw such letters into my wastebasket. And then I apologize for not throwing his letter into my wastebasket. But I didn't outfox Foxdahl. Hans had the last word. He sent that letter back, and the last words I heard from Lilac Terrace were, quote, your attitude is rotten, nasty, and stingy, so goodbye, Mr. Scrooge, unquote. Well, you can imagine how that made me feel, like a perfect brute. And this is Al, Gracious Cap, speaking to you on NBC's Monitor.
Al Cap, armed with opinions, is a regular feature each weekend on Monitor. Can you remember the days when a transistor radio was a novelty? It was not so long ago, you know. Today, the transistor, or battery-powered portable radio, is an important piece of family equipment. Last year alone, over 14 million transistors were bought by people who wanted to stay informed and entertained no matter where they went. With a portable radio, virtually any spot, indoors or out, is a potential listening post. So keep your set in good working condition and use it anywhere, anytime. You're hearing Enoch Lights Orchestra and Mondokane No. 2. Monitor, meanwhile, is No. 1, your best listening companion on the weekend anywhere in the nation. Folks in central Minnesota hear us on KFAM, St. Cloud, St. Cloud. A word from your nearest NBC station now, after which Monitor will continue. David Wayne here.
This is Monitor on the NBC Radio Network.
This is Monitor 66, keeping you up to date on significant people and events. I'm David Wayne. A few minutes from now, Ed Wynn will demonstrate the difference in jokes from 1902 to 1966. A bit later this half hour, Robin Moore, the author of The Green Berets, reveals his experiences in gathering material for his best-selling book. Vic Damone, always a bestseller with one of his latest numbers, whose title sounds like a poker hand, Two of a Kind.
Look into your eyes, and then I know if there was something wrong, your eyes would tell me so. Why try to fight it? You know you can't win. We're meant for each other. You might as well give in, 'cause we're two of a kind, two of a kind, you and I. Yes, we're two.
Monitor on stage. Known as the perfect fool, Ed Wynn. The occasion, the meeting of the Pennsylvania Association of Broadcasters held in Washington, at which Ed Wynn was the guest of honor and featured speaker.
It is a rare treat, ladies and gentlemen, for me to be back here in Washington. It's been some time since I've been here in this zip code area, so to speak. As a matter of fact, the last time that I called on President Johnson in the White House, it wasn't Lyndon, it was Andrew. Things have changed in this hotel. I remember with its former name. For instance, the moment I got in the hotel, I went right to the desk and I picked up the pen to register. At the same time, I asked the clerk, I said, what have you here for about $35? He says, you're holding it. But everything has changed, ladies and gentlemen. When I look back, like some men, for instance, if they open a store, the first dollar they take in, you know, they frame it. And I framed, and I have in my collection, the first joke I ever told on the stage, which was in 1902. I want to tell you the joke, and when you think that I got paid for that, well, here's the joke. A little boy is in the Delaware River yelling for help. A policeman jumps in, rescues the kid, brings him on the pier, drives him off for the town. As he's driving him, he says to the boy, he said, how did you come to fall in the river? And the kid said, I didn't come to fall in, I came to fish. Now, that was a big joke. 64 years ago. Let's see what has happened to humor or wit or whatever you call it today. Today, jokes must be so much more sophisticated, so much more avant-garde, so to speak. Now, here's a joke which I did not write, but to me is a very, very funny joke, excruciatingly funny to me. There is walking down the street an intoxicated man, very, very drunk, his hair all askew and his clothes in a filthy condition, and beard, four-day beard, and vice and corruption coming out of every pore, and he's so drunk. And he's walking down the street, and in the opposite direction is walking a rather large woman who is drunker than... She's stoned. She's gone. And her hair is all disheveled, and her clothes are disarrayed. And she, too, has got... She's in a horrible condition, and she's got a goose under her arm. Now, these two people, when the man comes up to her, he stops right in front, he says, "What are you doing with that pig?" And the woman says, "That's not a pig, that's a goose." He says, "I know it's a goose, that's who I'm talking to." You see, these are the kind of jokes you have to tell today. So they're entirely different.
Monitor on stage, and that was Ed Wynn addressing the Pennsylvania Association of Broadcasters dinner held in Washington.
Is this really happening? Am I only dreaming? I'm holding your hand. When I wake up to find I'm going out of my mind, if I'm asleep, let me keep running. Never felt the way that I'm feeling right now. And I don't know what to do. I'm going crazy for you. If I'm asleep, let me keep my dreaming. Let me dream. Don't pinch me. Just let me dream.
Georgia Gibbs, your friendly neighborhood dreamer. The author of The Green Berets tells us how he got permission to write his book and what he went through to gain battle knowledge and experience. That's just 1 minute from now here on the Monitor Beaker. Some of the most daring and dramatic jungle warfare in the Vietnamese conflict is being waged by the men of the U.S. Army's Special Forces, more commonly known as the Green Berets. The book of the same name was written by Robin Moore. How this book came to be written is an unusual story in itself. A story best told with the author. In this candid chat with Monitor reporter Jules Damancourt of NBC station WJBO, Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
Once upon a time, down in Jamaica. Could you tell us about that, sir?
Well, down in Jamaica, where I have a home and where I do most of my writing, all of my good creative writing, I happened to have the opportunity of meeting then Vice President of the United States, Lyndon B. Johnson, and his military aides. I had recently finished a book on guerrilla warfare in Cuba called The Devil to Pay. And I gave them copies of The Devil to Pay and told them I'd like to do my next book on U.S. Type guerrilla warfare and anti-guerrilla warfare. And we discussed special forces. They said, well, we'll give this some thought. The vice president's military aide took over the program, kept in touch with me, invited me to a meeting at the Pentagon in Washington, and there I had the opportunity of meeting some Special Forces people who said, yes, we'd be delighted to have you write a book about us, but first thing you better do is become parachute qualified. So they said you go to jump school and become a paratrooper at Fort Benning. Then you go down and take a field training exercise. And then after that, you'd go in the guerrilla warfare course that we give at Fort Bragg. And maybe after that, we might let you go to Vietnam, and then perhaps you can write a book about us. Well, I'm sure they thought that I would never get beyond jump school, but I did. And we then I did get through Swiss Strike 3, and I did get through the guerrilla training school, and then I did get through 6 months in Vietnam, and I did write the book. That's about the way it happened.
That's what we want to talk about. Could you tell us about some of the things in Vietnam? You were actually out there in the front lines wearing your Green Beret and participating with our Special Forces unit.
Well, yeah, I had a Green Beret. It was given to me by a Special Forces A-team after I got involved in a combat mission with them. We very seldom wear Green Berets in combat because that would be a number one target for the Viet Cong. So we just wore the same cloth hats as the natives that we were with over there. My first 6 months tour in Vietnam was spent pretty much in combat all over the country with Special Forces units.
There you are, an armed civilian fighting side by side with them. That's what I find hard to believe.
Well, that's right. I was a civilian. I'm the first civilian they ever let do this. And I always went armed because of my training. They let me go right out on combat patrols. And no Viet Cong was going to stop and say, "Oh, are you a non-combatant?" And I knew how to use a weapon, and I did on many occasions use it. I was a civilian, but I always went armed. I think I set a precedent. Traditionally, correspondents don't carry weapons. Most of them that I know now do carry weapons because they know that this is not like any other war we fought before. And if you're a Yankee, if you're a Caucasian, you're going to get zapped fast. You're your number one target.
Well, now, remembering you were out there with our special forces out on patrol, how does it feel being out there in the middle of a platoon realizing you get shot at behind every tree?
Well, the first thing you do is learn to be very careful and cautious. I've been on many patrols. We always watched carefully. I would always try to go on patrols with good, experienced men. We would constantly be getting ambushed. If we knew just what to do, what they call immediate reaction, you could fight your way out of an ambush, disperse it. Main thing, as I say, is to know what you're doing and be cautious. It is nerve-wracking, there's no doubt about it. You go out on an 8-day patrol into enemy-controlled territory, and you're getting shot at all the time. Of course, when you're not getting shot at, you're doing the shooting. We set up lots of ambushes. We had some very successful ambushes that I was in on where we destroyed the whole courier system of a Viet Cong regimental area by shooting their couriers as they came along paths, bringing notes from one headquarters to another. Then they would send in a squad to find out what happened to the courier. We'd zap the squad, and inevitably we would get hit too. And just a constant game of almost like leapfrog. We hit them, they hit us, we hit them. Small action, very personal fights. Close in, you see the face of the man you're killing. As you're doing it, he sees you getting him. He's trying to kill you. You're trying to kill him. Very personal, dirty, hand-to-hand war that we're fighting every day over there, and something you never get used to.
There's something I didn't fully understand in the book, this business about do it in 30 seconds or you're in trouble. What does that mean?
Well, if you're going to get into a combat hand-to-hand situation with an enemy, you don't know how many friends he's got, and you don't know how good he is. If you can kill him first, and 30 seconds is a long time, they try to teach you to do it in a matter of 10 or 12 seconds, you have much more chance of survival than if it takes you longer than that. So therefore, most hand-to-hand techniques are the immediate 1, 2, 3, 5 second kills, because that is what's going to keep you alive. Get him before he can make any noise, if possible.
We certainly do want to thank you for being here with us today. We've been speaking with Mr. Robin Moore, the author of The Green Beret. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me over.
And this is Jules Demicourt reporting for Monitor, and now back to Radio Central.
The exploits of the Green Berets will receive even wider attention in the near future since the movie rights to Mr. Moore's book have been purchased. Another reason for the current interest in the Green Beret story is the hit song, The Ballad of the Green Berets. Now a brand new one continues to honor these special fighting men. It's titled The A-Team and is sung by Barry Sadler.
12 men, strong and true. 12 men fight for you. On their heads a beret of green. 12 men, invincible, the A-Team.
In one moment, Lindsey Nelson and the switch in the fans' approach to spring training. Monitor Sports is brought to you by Plymouth Fury, Belvedere, Valiant, Barracuda, Plymouth 66.
There goes another Plymouth. Plymouth sales have more than doubled in the last 3 years. And it's no wonder our hot sales pace continues with 66 Plymouth Fury. Big new beauty. In a great big hurry. Most exciting Plymouth ever. With engine options all the way up to a 4-barrel, 440 cubic inch Commando V8. There goes another Plymouth. Time after time, day after day, somebody new wakes up, takes off with Plymouth's own special brand of performance. Isn't it time you let yourself go with a beautiful big new Fury at your Plymouth dealers? Plymouth, a great car by Chrysler Corporation. There goes another one.
This is Lindsey Nelson at Major League Baseball spring training in Florida for Monitor Sports. Perhaps you heard that the tourists have been flocking to Florida this winter in numbers larger than ever before. For most of the state, the standing room only sign has been out for weeks, and a large percentage of the visitors are baseball fans who take advantage of the opportunity to see some of their heroes in circumstances a little less pressurized than they become later on. In case you haven't noticed, there have been a lot of changes made in recent years in the manner in which Major League Baseball teams get from their spring training bases to their home cities. There was a time when barnstorming tours featuring one-day stands were the order of the day. Teams left Florida by train and played their way north with stops at any town or city that was large enough to have a ballpark. The train was the hotel. While the game was being played, the train waited in a siding. The players changed clothes and hotel rooms and then reboarded the train for the move to the next city. It was during these trips that the fans in the cities of the Southland got an opportunity to see their heroes up close. With the decline of the minor leagues, the coming of television, and the age of the jet airplane, the lengthy barnstorming tour has all but disappeared. Teams still play a few games here and there, but for the most part, it's a jump from Florida right to the major league city where opening day is scheduled. And since the teams don't visit the fans in the non-major league cities, the fans have decided to visit the teams in Florida. The big fan bonus comes around the hotel lobbies. For instance, this week at the hotel which houses the New York Mets on St. Petersburg Beach, Casey Stengel held forth at considerable length on a variety of subjects, ranging from baseball as played under John McGraw to the care and use of the modern walking cane. The fans who congregated in the lobby didn't understand him too well, but they listened and marveled just the same. And Yogi Berra and his family were popular figures, too. Yogi is still one of the most sought-after figures in the game. The fans haven't forgotten for a minute that this is the guy who came off the sandlots of St. Louis to become three times the most valuable player in the American League and then the manager of the New York Yankees. Apparently, Yogi was never happier than he is in his role as a coach with the Mets. He spends long hours instructing young ball players in the art of catching and hitting. And his son, Larry, attends the workouts wearing one of his father's uniforms with a familiar number 8. And Larry is now big enough to stretch his dad's suit a little bit. And this week, the Mets and Yankees were scheduled to play a game in St. Petersburg, but they were rained out. It was a big disappointment for the fans who had hoped to see the meeting of the two New York teams. For the few fans who did show up at the park in the rain, however, there was quite a little bit of excitement. Although the Yankees didn't dress, they were at the ballpark, and some of the fans got to visit in the stands with Mickey Mantle, Whitey Ford, Joe Pepitone, and others. That's the way it is in Florida in the springtime. The teams don't often visit the fans on the way north anymore, but the fans in increasing numbers are visiting the teams. This is Lindsey Nelson at Major League Baseball Spring Training in Florida for Monitor Sports.
The stars, the stories, and the most complete coverage of the world of sports every weekend on Monitor. Joe Harnell's orchestra, and near you, near or far, if it's news, you'll hear it on NBC Monitor News on the Hour. That's next, so stay tuned. This is David Wayne.
This is Kurt Gowdy. I'll be with you all weekend with my Monitor Outdoor Show on NBC Radio.